lower the ride, avoiding a riskier rescue. Officials say all the riders were medically evaluated and there were no reports of injury. Mark Remillard, ABC News.
A San Francisco park where a grandmother was beaten and later died of her injuries is being renamed in her honor today. The Yikoi Huang Peace and Friendship Park will have a ribbon-cutting ceremony today, 5.5 years after the 88-year-old was attacked on her daily morning walk. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
The John and Gordy Show.
I've told you 1,000 times in the show, and no one has believed me, but I'm apolitical. I don't look at things that way. I want to see what works and what doesn't, okay. What saves us money and what will help most people. Mm-hmm. I mean, the people who have already made it, who are wealthy, already have benefited from a system that we all have put into. They should pay back a little bit.
Weekday mornings 6 until 8 on Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX and on the Civic Media app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
This broad reaching, well, we can't help people because we can't control how they spend the money, somehow magically doesn't apply to billionaires, doesn't apply to corporations who dodge their taxes every year. The only people who are subject to the conservative morality police are poor people. How dare you?
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays at 2 on Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX and on the Civic Media app.
Impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies, because feeling full can sound like this.
How did the interview go?
I did it! I got the job! I can't believe it!
And like this.
Mom, I got first place at the science fair with my volcano project!
That's amazing, sweetie. Congratulations!
Because when people are fed, futures are nourished, and everyone deserves to live a full life. Join the movement to end hunger at feedingamerica.org/act now. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Why choose Weikert Realtors? Because your community is our community. We're your neighbors, your students, your chefs, your soldiers, your builders, your actors, your musicians, and your radio personalities. We love this city as much as you do, and that's why we want to help you live your best life here. Because we are your realtors. Call us today and let us help you find your next home. 608-821-7002 or visit Weikert-LakePoint.com. Weikert Realtors Lake Point, a home for all.
Max Inc. on Civic Media, live in the lair with Kaylin Cole.
Have you ever walked away from a karaoke performance thinking, yeah, that was a lot better than the original person?
Oh my gosh, I don't know if I should admit that or not.
I think you should. Because now we know there's a song.
Jimmy's tugging on it now.
I know. Oh, you're going to get me in trouble, Jimmy.
It's live in the lair. Grab the podcast now at MaxIncRadio.com and listen live on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm Terry Bell with WMDX News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section on the WMDX website at mad.radio.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. A new report shows Wisconsin does a great job providing resources to keep some kids happy and healthy. However, white kids are benefiting the most, while research shows the Badger State is the worst in the nation for black families. Mike Moen reports.
An annual report suggests Wisconsin has a strong foundation in creating positive outcomes for kids. But low test scores and racial disparities show not all youth are faring well. The Annie E. Casey Foundation's latest Kids Count data book ranks Wisconsin 11th in the country for child well-being. The state saw a slight dip in its child poverty rate, falling to 13%. However, Emily Mayota of the statewide policy group Kids Forward says the positive results mask persistent disparities for the Badger State.
Wisconsin remains the worst state in the nation for black children and families.
For example, black children were 29 times more likely to live in high-poverty areas than white children. Those disparities also spill over into education. The report contends the pandemic is not solely to blame for the country's worsening educational outcomes. The Casey Foundation's Leslie Bossier says educators, researchers, policymakers, and employers who track students' academic readiness have been ringing alarm bells for a long time.
The pandemic erased decades of increases in MAP scores. However, if you look over the 35 years that we've produced the data book, we've never seen a significant percentage of children who were either proficient in fourth grade reading or basic math.
The report calls on all states to expand access to intensive tutoring for students who are behind in their classes and missing academic milestones. Wisconsin did see a worsening rate of young children not attending school. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, partly sunny, highs in the upper 70s to near 80. For tonight, showers and storms and a low of 67. Showers and thunderstorms on Sunday, warmer, highs near 92, the heat index of 96. For Monday, mostly sunny and hot, with highs near 93.
Right now, it's 65.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time when we're back in the studios of Madison celebrating our Civic Media Scotty Summer Text to Win Win. Join us, all that and more, review of the weekend's news. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2. This is Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
And this is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media statewide here in Wisconsin and beyond in many other venues throughout this great nation. Thank you so much for joining me on this weekend weekly review of all things related to government and the rule of law, the administration of justice in our nation, and also beyond, often in other places around our globe. Amicus Law Review. Of course, we take our name, as always, from this word amicus. It's a legal term. It is derived, as you now know well, from the Latin. It describes a friend. Ami is the portion of that term that is relevant. That's an individual, an organization that somehow assists, promotes some understanding, some appreciation of some relevant issues, some things that are topical, focus of attention by a particular group or entity, and needing resolution, offering through this amicus process some information, some insight, or some perspective, some expertise that may be helpful to that entity in making a decision, understanding the world in which we live. And indeed, that is our mission. That's our purpose, our goal here on this broadcast every weekend. It also involves you as well, our listeners. We invite, strongly encourage your questions, your comments, your inquiries about what is always an ambitious but achievable syllabus here on Amicus, a law review, inviting you to call in at 844-967-2789, or also much available, accessible to text us. Drop us a note in our feed on the Civic Media app. Both Max and I are here this weekend in the broadcast studio of Civic Media. We're located in Waukesha, but we're taking your calls and your inquiries from across the state and beyond. That number once again, 844-967-2789, or the Civic Media app. Join us here on in our conversation of all things rule of law. Now, what is our syllabus this morning, this weekend here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media? It is, not surprisingly, a focus on the United States Supreme Court. As we have talked at great length in previous broadcasts of this show and others, this is a time period in America when our United States Supreme Court begins to issue, and does indeed issue, some of those major opinions that define who we are, both presently and in the future, not disappointing us at all. The Supreme Court now beginning to issue some of those cases. We're going to spend some time, a lot of time, this weekend talking about at least four of those cases that have dropped, so to speak, just this past week from the United States Supreme Court. Significant cases in the area of, yes, that's right, firearms, a significant case in the area of abortion, of labor and also intellectual property, sort of to round out those four cases. The Supreme Court actually issued cases in six different areas just this past week. There's another case involving Chapter 11 proceedings, another case involving remand proceedings and removal proceedings involving immigration issues. We're going to spend most of our time talking about those other four cases. And before we do that, to set some standards, to set some foundational work here, let's talk about where the Supreme Court is right now. Because, yes, it has begun to issue some of these critical, all-important rulings just this past week, and, yes, a bit in the previous weeks. But the reality is that out of the 62 cases that the Supreme Court has decided to review and analyze and give us its judgments on in this, the 2023-2024 term, the reality is that they have issued opinions in 38 of those, 38. So if my math is good, that means that there are 24 more cases for our highest court in the land to issue. And they have approximately 13 business days in which to do that. Now, the Supreme Court sets its own schedule, does not have to follow that kind of calendar at all. Traditionally, as we have likewise engaged here on this broadcast station and others around the state, as we have talked on a regular basis, it is common practice for the Supreme Court historically to issue these decisions in the month of June and then somewhat into the month of July, very, very casually. The Independence Day holiday, of course, July 4th every year, is pretty much the end of their active, not term, but the active time of their issuing these opinions. And so between now and the 4th of July, there are 13, count them, a whopping 13 business days for the Supreme Court to issue these opinions. Now, it could, and it has rarely in the past, gone beyond that July 4th date, but highly likely that sometime in the next 13 business days, that, of course, is a bit more, right around 3 weeks or so, the Supreme Court is going to be issuing 24 different decisions. And so the speed with which these decisions are coming out from the Supreme Court presumably is going to increase. And on a decision day, so to speak, it may well be that the Supreme Court will issue 2, 3, sometimes even 4 opinions. And while that is not unprecedented, the reality is that in past years, the Supreme Court has been issuing these with somewhat greater regularity, even in this time, mid-June, late June, and then again right before the 4th of July. It has begun to do that, and there's no doubt that among the four cases we're going to talk about with great precision on this, our weekend broadcast, it still has a lot to do, many decisions, and it's entirely possible that some of those cases are still under review, perhaps still being drafted, still being exchanged among them. Not unusual, of course, for the Supreme Court to make some preliminary internal decisions about who is voting in what direction, and then those decisions, the majority opinion in any event, assigned to one of the justices to write, to issue ultimately. And it's entirely possible that those decisions, those drafts, are now being prepared and that they're being exchanged to determine who is on the majority side, who may be dissenting, expressing disagreement with the majority opinions, all of that likely going on, who may be writing, as we will learn this weekend, who may be writing concurrences, that is, these opinions saying, I agree with the majority disposition, but there's something about that majority case, that resolution, that strikes me as wrong or needs more exposition. We'll see a bit of that this weekend on Amicus, a Law Review. All of that going on. And so what is beyond the cases already decided just this past week and a bit previously, and again, it has decided 38 of the 62 cases, so it's beyond half, well beyond half, but still a lot of work to do. What are the kinds of things that are still on the docket, on this docket for the Supreme Court coming up in this term? Many of those cases we know that they're pending and they will be the subject of a lot of focus. We know that the immunity case involving Donald Trump, this claim that he has made that he is immune from prosecution, that has not yet been resolved, going to impact dramatically the pendency, the prosecution of that case, pending right now in front of Tanya Chutkan, but suspended, the trial suspended, while the Supreme Court determines whether or not a president of the United States of America is immune for some or perhaps some subset of crimes that he, perhaps one day she, will commit. It is an extraordinary thing, as we have talked about at great length in the past, that the Supreme Court is taking this issue seriously, a matter rejected as being frivolous by me and many others out there who regarded this issue as frivolous, as ridiculous, and yet the Supreme Court perhaps headed toward defining some set of activities, criminal in nature, in which a president could engage that would not be subject to prosecution, a stunning thing that may be coming out. That is still pending. Prediction here, probably going to be issued among the very last cases of this term. We'll be focusing on that as well. The companion case, this Fisher case we've also talked about, that is the case asking whether or not one of these statutes under which Donald Trump and about 300 of the January 6 rioters have been prosecuted, some of them in process, many of them convicted, many of them sentenced under this particular statute. The question is, how do you apply that statute? And the language, as we've talked before, what does it mean? What is it intended to do? What does the legislature mean by establishing this particular statute? Does it apply to the rioters on the ground on January 6th? And derivatively, even though Donald Trump's name is not involved in that particular case called Fisher, how would that disposition impact, have an effect upon the case pending in front of Tanya Chutkan, that major election interference case? That's the federal case, four counts against Donald Trump, suspended by the pendency of those two cases. We have not yet heard from the Supreme Court on either one of those. There's a case involving emergency abortion care, which we know about as well, coming out of the state of Idaho, which has passed a ban on abortions. The interplay, the intersection, the conflict between that, the Idaho law, and a federal law that mandates, as it is interpreted by the Biden administration, mandates providing medical care, life-saving, health-promoting medical care for pregnant women if indeed that pregnancy is causing the nature of their physical harm, requiring that doctors, in appropriate circumstances, engage in those reproductive and abortion services, arguably in violation of Idaho law, with the Supreme Court determining which one holds sway. Is it the state law? Is it the federal law? And determining whether or not the so-called supremacy clause that traditionally is a part of our understanding when it comes to these kinds of cases, whether the federal law is in fact the highest law in the land. That is still pending. We're going to talk about a gun case, a major case just issued on Friday of this past week. But there's another one pending, which we've spent a lot of time talking about, called Rahimi. The question there, determining whether or not someone who is subject to a state-imposed domestic violence restraining order can use weapons. There is a federal law that says, that is established a long time ago, that if in fact you are subject to a restraining order imposed by a state court, you can't possess, you can't buy, you can't sell, cannot use firearms. Mr. Rahimi, a very violent person, maintains that that's in violation of his Second Amendment rights under Bruin, under Heller, under other authorities that are out there. Supreme Court determining whether or not that federal law that prohibits him from possessing weapons is constitutional. Probably in that case, going to uphold the law. But we'll see. That case also pending. Restrictions on the homeless. That case also pending. Restrictions and limitations on social media providers and platforms. What can they do? What they cannot do? The prerogatives of legislators to impose requirements to provide information about any time that a platform provider brings down content, engages in what's called content moderation. Can legislatures restrict and direct the conduct of social media providers in those kinds of circumstances? We're going to be talking more about all of this throughout our weekend broadcast. Stay with us here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to Mad Radio WMDX, Madison's home for the Todd Lobel Show.
Pizza's here.
Oh, great. I'd love some, but I'm worried about my stomach issues.
If you're worried about having diarrhea, gas, bloating, stomach pain, or loose, oily stools, it may not just be stomach issues. It could be a condition called exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, or EPI. With EPI, the pancreas doesn't release enough enzymes to break down food, but EPI is manageable. Use the symptom checker on identifyepi.com and talk to your doctor. That's identifyepi.com. Sponsored by AbbVie.
Sure, the home seller's market is hot right now, but that means many people are jumping at the first offer. When you sell with the most trusted name in real estate, the Aaron Weber Group at First Weber, you're guaranteed the hottest offer, making you the most money for your home. The Aaron Weber Group, powered by First Weber, your local realtor, friend, and neighbor, has your best interest in mind and wants you to make the most of this amazing time to sell. Bring a little heat to your home selling experience with Aaron Weber Group. And move to Madison.com.
Mad Radio 92.7 FM, home of the John and Gordy Show.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour of our broadcast, and also the next hour as well, as always, inviting your questions and your inquiries about our syllabus at 844-967-2789. Also, very much encouraging your dropping a note to my producer, Max, or me on the Civic Media app. Likewise, presenting your question, your inquiry about the subject matter of our discussion this weekend. It is going to be all things Supreme Court this weekend because the Supreme Court, once again, becoming increasingly active in addressing its considerable important caseload in this term. Among the cases, as I was reviewing them, still to be resolved are cases related to social media. Lots of cases about the interaction between government and social media providers, platform providers. What is that all about? We'll find out from the Supreme Court. There is a major opioid settlement case involving a Purdue Pharma that is also the subject of review by the Supreme Court. Can a bankruptcy court, in resolving the Sackler family's financial situation there, can they basically stop other claims from going forward if those are a part of the overall bankruptcy plan and practice there? Supreme Court having before it the opioid crisis as it may in part imperfectly being resolved by the bankruptcy court. What is the power of that court in determining whether claims will survive beyond bankruptcy? A huge amount of attention, including some of the cases that we are going to be talking about this weekend on the power of federal agencies. As frequent listeners to this broadcast know, for a very long period of time, I maintain that these cases having to do with agency authorization, the attack on the so-called, although non-existent, administrative state, were among the most important cases in this docket until the Supreme Court began to entertain seriously the possibility, the ridiculous notion that a chief executive may be immune. These cases, nonetheless, are in a very, very close second spot, a number of them having to do with whether or not the federal courts should defer to agency determinations when it comes to understanding the laws of our land, the laws passed by our legislature, envisioning that agencies have authorities and prerogatives, and determining whether or not federal courts should defer appropriately under reasonable circumstances to the people inside those agencies who know what they're talking about. They're the experts of the people who have been experienced in the areas to which they have been assigned. The question in a number of cases, including a number of cases that go directly to this 40-year-old tradition called Chevron, that contemplates that deference, is the Supreme Court going to toss that concept out? Number of cases addressing that issue, and we will talk about those as well as the Supreme Court issues those. Administrative issues loom very large in this term of the United States Supreme Court. Also a case involving cross-state air pollution, one of the only air quality cases, Ohio versus Environmental Protection Agency. The court there deciding whether to temporarily stop the Biden administration's so-called good neighbor plan that requires factories and power plants in some western and midwestern states to cut air pollution that drifts over the air into the eastern states. That also, That also on the docket of the Supreme Court. That's among the 24 cases still to be decided. A lot of things happening in the month of June. And yes, indeed, on this broadcast and probably others of the broadcast stations generally of civic media, we're going to be talking about those, because as this overly simplified review of the categories, the kinds of things the Supreme Court is addressing, indicates, these are big deals, as a colleague of mine recently said. And among those big deals, some specific cases issued just this past week. We're going to talk about those. They have to do with bump stocks and guns. They have to do with abortion, a drug called mifepristone, which we have also talked about at great length on this broadcast. Case involving labor and Starbucks. And again, the authority, the responsibilities under the law with respect to union organizing. And then there is a seemingly frivolous but actually fairly important intellectual property case that the Supreme Court issued, which also generated, believe it or not, a lot of dissenting and concurring opinions by members of the Supreme Court on whether or not a particular phrase involving our former president, Donald Trump, can in fact be copyrighted under the laws of our federal government. All of that coming up. We know as well as all of this happens from the United States Supreme Court, this is the period, this is the time of year when they issue all of these cases. Even so, lots of things going on in the federal courts of our land. We know that the president's son, Hunter Biden, was convicted this past Tuesday of those violations of the federal firearms law. He is still facing tax evasion and tax issue counts out in California, even as the disposition of the firearms case in Delaware has now come to a close with a finding by a unanimous jury of guilt with respect to those particular charges. We know that Senator Bob Menendez continues to be tried in a federal district court in Manhattan, in New York. That goes on. A lot of fascinating and frankly troubling testimony about the nature of his engagement with overseas agents and authorities. What was he doing in connection with the use, perhaps, arguably, that's the allegation, of his own job, his own position as a United States senator? Was he accepting bribes? Was he selling his office? The government says yes. He says no and points principally to his spouse, among other things. She will be tried later on, but that case continues to be tried. And also another significant event having to do with Alex Jones just this past week. Alex Jones, again, in the land of reviews in these cases involving him and the imposition of a number of months ago of liability for the things he said, suggesting that the massacre of young people and others at Sandy Hook many years ago was not real, suffers these appropriately entered civil judgments. This past week, the judge overseeing the bankruptcy case there ordered the sale of Alex Jones's personal assets to try to begin to pay off those judgments in favor of the families of the victims of the Sandy Hook incident there. He does, however, keep InfoWars in place. That's the business. That's the online information providing source from Alex Jones. Hesitate even to describe it that way because, again, InfoWars, the source of an awful lot of not just bad but downright inaccurate information. This past week, the judge ordering Alex Jones to sell much of his personal property, his assets, but keeps him on the air, if you will, even as all of those cases go ahead. Lots of things going on in the rule of law in America and beyond, including this major case that we have talked about before involving bump stocks. Supreme Court, just on Friday of this past week, striking down a ban, a prohibition on bump stocks entered administratively. This is a rule of the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau, striking down that rule that enabled semi-automatic rifles to fire, that is bump stocks, enabling semi-automatic rifles to fire at speeds that basically rival those of machine guns. And it effectively, this decision by the Supreme Court just this past week, erases one of the government's rare firearm regulations that resulted from a mass shooting. Now, the decision, a 6-3 split, right down so-called ideological lines, this decision coming out just this past week,
Justice Clarence Thomas, writing for the majority, said that, yes, indeed, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives has exceeded its powers when it prohibited the device by issuing a ruling, a restriction, a limitation that classified these things, these bump stocks, as machine guns. He said this, we hold that the semiotic rifle...
You're listening to Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. President Biden's arrived in Los Angeles, where he'll take part tonight in a star-studded fundraiser, the age of the presumptive major party nominees in focus this weekend. First Lady Jill Biden said Friday at the launch of Seniors for Biden in Reno, age is a good thing.
Age is a gift, but there are still those who devalue our wisdom and dismiss our experience.
Former President Trump turned 78 yesterday. He'll campaign in Detroit today. Some of the survivors of the 2017 Las Vegas shooting calling for federal action to ban bump stocks, the devices that allow a semi-automatic weapon to fire multiple rounds, after the Supreme Court Friday overturned the ATF's ban on bump stocks. It's up to Congress to pass a law. Kate, the Princess of Wales, made her first public appearance since announcing she was being treated for cancer for the King's birthday parade in London. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Brewers lose to the Reds. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers tried to make a comeback but lost to the Reds 6-5 at AmFam Field. It was a special night in the broadcast booth as the team celebrated the 30th anniversary of analyst and former catcher Bill Schroeder. Many of his former colleagues stopped by to call the game, including Jim Paschke on Bally Sports.
William Contreras, deep to center field. Down, a home run. His ninth of the year. The Brewers have passed.
Are you practicing a home run call today? Very nice.
College football, another exciting recruit, commits to Wisconsin. Eugene Hilton, the son of former Colts receiver Ty Hilton, has agreed to play for the Badgers. NBA Finals, the Dallas Mavericks came back to dominate in Game 4. They beat the Celtics 122-84. Kyrie Irving with 21 points in the lopsided win.
Yeah, it's not going to be easy in Boston, so got to look forward to the challenge.
Game 5 Monday night in Boston, the Celtics up 3-1. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, partly sunny, highs in the upper 70s to near 80. For tonight, showers and storms and a low of 67. Showers and thunderstorms on Sunday, warmer, highs near 92, the heat index of 96. For Monday, mostly sunny and hot, with highs near 93.
Currently, 66 degrees.
At Civic Media, we encourage active political engagement and remind listeners to think critically about political advertisements you may hear during this critical election year. Our stations are licensed by the FCC and are required to accept all ads for federal candidates. We also air state and local candidates, as well as paid ads from issue and PAC groups. Truth is rarely as simple as any political ad may claim. So again, we urge you to think critically about what you hear in the spirit of promoting authentic and respectful civic dialogue.
It's June Dairy Month, and though more than 5 million people call Wisconsin home, we share our state with close to 1.5 million cows. Those beautiful animals. Yes, okay, I grew up on a dairy farm outside of Green Bay. They've been here since before we became a state. Can you answer this? Most of our cow's milk currently makes which product? Is it butter, cheese, or ice cream? The answer coming up. Wisconsin's first official milk plant, 1894 in the Waupun area of Fond du Lac County. Fast forward more than 120 years, now farmer-owned with a second location in the Outagamie County village of Black Creek, the Saputo plant is even featured on History Channel's Modern Marvels for its award-winning cheesemaking. So did you guess? Most of our cow's milk, 90% of it currently makes cheese. Gouda for you! Celebrating our dairy farmers with this slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 11 till noon on the talk you can't ignore. Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX and on the Civic Media app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
John Peterson and Gordy Young.
On our next show, Dana Pelabon will join us.
The Dane County executive race is heating up.
Talk to you Monday morning.
The John and Gordy Show, weekday mornings 6 until 8 on Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour and next hour as well, here in the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We're talking all things Supreme Court this weekend as a part of our talking with you about what's going on in the law, government, and the aspiration for justice, discussing in particular this major case issued just on Friday of this past week that strikes down a ban on bump stocks. Those, again, these devices that enable semi-automatic rifles to fire at speeds that are like those of machine guns. Machine guns under federal law prohibited. The question whether or not these particular devices can indeed be regulated by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms by a 6-3 split court, not surprisingly, right down ideological lines. Justice Clarence Thomas writing, "We hold that a semi-automatic rifle equipped with a bump stock is not a machine gun, because it cannot fire more than one shot by a single function of the trigger." That's what he writes. The opinion, of course, includes several diagrams, which is somewhat atypical, several diagrams of the firing mechanism. Why? Because this issue, this determination about whether or not this indeed is a device that can be regulated, has to do with a very particular understanding of what it does and what it doesn't do. He describes in technical detail the internal workings of a firearm to show how a bump stock actually works. We're going to get back to that in just a moment or so and analyze exactly what the Supreme Court has said in an opinion that many people, including me, feel is very much focused on semantics, recognizing that lawyers love to do those kinds of things. Here you've got a Supreme Court that is holding very closely to the narrow language of the particular rule here and finding that the ATF does not have regulatory authority. It is undeniably a guns case, but more importantly, it's also a case involving this continuing review of administrative agencies. This time it's ATF, the administrator of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Right now, that is a fellow named Steve Dettelbach. He was a colleague of mine, still a friend of mine, former U.S. attorney under the Biden administration. We both worked for Eric Holder. He is a very good and decent person, advocating, of course, in his professional capacity, that this rule would be one that keeps people safe. The ATF being told by the Supreme Court, again, in this agency determination of just this past week, that it cannot enforce that rule, even though it comes from and derives from an horrific event. What do we know about that event? Well, we know on the night of October 1 of 2017, yes, it's been almost 7 years or so, a gunman who smuggled some rifles and reams of ammunition into a suite of rooms on the 32nd floor of a Las Vegas hotel, opened fire. His target at the time, a crowd attending a Route 91 Harvest Country Musical Festival in the area just below that hotel. Gunman at that time killed 58 people and also himself. That's significant because we never really determined exactly what the motive for this was. What we do know is that hundreds more concert goers were also injured. In addition to the people, the 58 people whose lives were lost that day, all of those injured in a very frantic rush to escape the rapid fire bursts. And that's relevant to this case. These rapid fire bursts of gunfire that were quite literally raining down from the room at the Mandalay Bay Resort where the gunman was positioned. Two of those who were wounded in that melee later on died. Now, about a dozen of the firearms, the rifles that this gunman used at the time, were later found by people investigating, the investigators themselves, the agents, the law enforcement, that they had been modified with these devices. Yes, that's right. The devices known as bump stocks. These devices, again, catch the attention, of course, of all of us. They're known. They've been out there for a while. And as a result of that, a huge amount of focus inside and outside government on whether or not these things, these bump stocks that enabled this gunman to engage in this absolutely catastrophic event in October of 2017, should they likewise be subject to restriction and outlaw by a rule, a restriction of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And we'll talk more about what the Trump administration in saying, yes, that they should in fact be limited. The accessories generally cost as little as about $99. They replace a rifle's standard stock, and that's the part that's held against the shoulder. The bump stock frees the weapon to basically slide back and forth rapidly, which is something that the Supreme Court spent a lot of time talking about in its opinion of just this past week. It basically harnesses, it grabs the energy from the kickback that shooters feel when that weapon fires, and that makes a semi-automatic rifle more like a machine gun. The Las Vegas gunman, under those physics principles, was able to fire more than 1,000 rounds in about 11 minutes. 1,000 rounds in about 11 minutes. And so as a result of that, this attention paid in the wake of this horrific melee in October of 2017, the government, and in particular, the administration of Donald Trump, enacts this ban after this gunman does in fact accomplish what he plainly set out to do, one of the deadliest massacres in modern American history. The Trump administration then pursues this effort to stop the sale of bump stocks in America, successful in doing so. And that administrative ruling, of course, extended, continued, supported by the Biden administration. And indeed, in the wake of what happened in Las Vegas, people, good, reasonable, thoughtful people who are concerned about safety and security in America on all sides of the political aisle, people on the left, the right, in between, Republicans, Democrats, all supported a ban on bump stocks. The Trump administration, the Biden administration, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms that knows what they're doing, these are the experts inside this agency, now not just second-guessed, but told that they're wrong. And a narrowly written decision by the Supreme Court here focuses upon the language of this particular rule. The court, of course, has, as we indicate at the top of our broadcast, has at least one other major decision coming out that has to do with this Rahimi case and whether or not someone who is subject to a domestic violence restraining order can properly, legally, lawfully carry, use a firearm. That's a federal law as well. We haven't yet heard about that. That's a pretty much straightforward guns case. But here, in addition to invoking issues related to bump stocks and guns generally, this is also a case about whether or not the Supreme Court defers to the decision and the expertise inside of ATF under this precedent, this doctrine we've talked about a lot called Chevron. And again, it is in this category of cases in which the Supreme Court continues to address whether or not our federal agencies can do what they are assigned by the legislature to do. The bump stock decision of just this past week could indeed signal that these justices, at least the conservative justices on the court, could be in line to curb even more authorities of other administrative agencies out there. We know that the SEC is also on the line in another case. We know that a national fisheries agency, likewise in the big case pending out there, is also the subject of the Supreme Court's review. Now, Justice Sonia Sotomayor summarized her dissent from the bench. She disagreed very strongly with this opinion from the majority written by Justice Clarence Thomas. She is joined, not surprisingly, by Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who fire back in strong terms and say, no, this is just plain wrong, placing semantics and language over the practical import of what this rule is intended to do. Justice Sotomayor summarized her dissent from the bench, which is not unknown, but it's still rare. And it is undertaken by a Supreme Court justice when they feel very strongly about their position articulated in their dissent. The majority, Justice Sotomayor says, puts machine guns back in civilian hands. That's what she says from the bench. That's what she writes in her dissenting opinion. And here's what she says. She says, when I see a bird that walks like a duck, swims like a duck, and quacks like a duck, I call that bird a duck. A bump stock, she goes on to say, a bump stock equipped semi-automatic rifle fires automatically more than one shot without manual reloading by a single function of the trigger. It goes on to say, because I, like Congress, call that a machine gun, I respectfully dissent. And again, she's joined in that by Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Now, it's significant to know as well that under a thing called the National Firearms Act of 1934, Congress, our legislature, specifically outlawed machine guns. Those are defined as any weapon which shoots or designed to shoot or can readily be restored to shoot automatically more than one shot without manual reloading by a single function of the trigger. Now, that sounds very, very specific. It is important because that's the language upon which this case turns. It is not a decision based upon the policy decisions here. That definition was expanded under something called the Gun Control Act of 1968, also by our legislature. It remains the law of our nation. It included that at that time parts that can be used to convert a weapon into a machine gun, a category that has been heavily regulated, including here, with respect to bump stocks, by the ATF. As I indicated, the Supreme Court spending a lot of time talking about exactly what happens here, that bump stock freeing the weapon to slide back and forth. Justice Thomas spending a lot of time in his majority opinion talking about that, this kickback that shooters feel when the weapon fires. The justices appear divided over whether that counted as one pull of the trigger are multiple. And so you've got this opinion and the dissenting opinions that are focused on exactly what is going on when a bump stock is attached. Under the Trump administration rule, under the Biden rule, bump stocks were considered illegal. And as a result of that, this case now coming to the Supreme Court, the response of this from across the nation is, of course, strong. Those people who feel strongly, as I suspect many of you do, that safety and security, especially when it comes to firearms in America, has got to be one of our top priorities. We continue to have these major numbers of major shootings, mass shootings in America. We are still on track again in this calendar year to post record numbers of mass shootings. This is the kind of thing, it is a small thing, candidly, that ATF can and should do to try to keep us safe and secure. And the fact that the Supreme Court has now said, ATF, you can't do this, and has determined based upon the language of the law and the specific function, how this thing works, it is disappointing at a minimum. All of this comes in the wake of the plaintiff, the petitioner here. His name is Mr. Cargill. He said he was working on his bed on his iPad when he refreshed the Supreme Court decision on this, and it came up. He said, I was ecstatic. This is the fellow who brought the case, and the first time, he said, for the first time in my life, I was at a loss for words. The case, of course, a victory for gun rights advocates and others, although once again, not so much a gun case as it is a case involving language and a case involving the capacity of agencies to do its job. A bump stock does not convert a semi-automatic rifle into a machine gun any more than a shooter with a lightning-fast trigger finger does. That's what Justice Clarence Thomas said at the time of his rendition of this opinion. Occurring opinion by Sam Alito largely agreed with that and says that there is simply no other way to read the statutory language. Alito goes on to say the horrible shooting spree in Las Vegas in 2017 did not change the statutory text or its meaning. There is a simple remedy for the disparate treatment of bump stocks and machine guns. He says Congress can amend the law. And again, Justice Sotomayor could not disagree more. What does she say? That today the court puts bump stocks back in civilian hands. To do so, it casts aside Congress's definition of machine gun and seizes upon one that is inconsistent with the ordinary meaning of the statutory text and is unsupported by the context or the purpose. She finally says, this is not a hard case. The majority opinion, she says, looks to the internal mechanism that initiates fire rather than the human act of the shooter's initial pull. That's an interpretation that requires six diagrams, she says, and an animation to decipher the meaning of the statutory text. She is plainly making reference to those things that show up in the opinion. Again, sometimes done, but it's atypical. And again, we have in the wake of this significant decision coming out of the Supreme Court just yesterday, a further diminution of the capacity of an agency, in this case ATF, to make decisions that keep us safe and secure, and also an opinion that reverses this all-important rule, this regulation by ATF with respect to bump stocks in our nation. That case coming out of the Supreme Court just on Friday of this past week, among the 62 that it has been reviewing. When we return here on Amicus Law Review, we're going to talk about yet another case, a series of cases on Thursday of this past week. Stay with us for that discussion as well.
Mad Radio 92.7 FM, home of the John and Gordy Show.
Hey there, this is Carrie Joy with today's Work Money Minute and a little bit of tough love about investing in collectibles. I'm going to say this as nicely as I can. Collectibles are just not good investments. Comic books, Beanie Babies, World War II memorabilia, American Girl doll stuff, they just don't math out as investments. Now, collecting as a hobby that brings you joy is perfectly fine if you can afford it. Just don't confuse the fun of the hunt with the potential for profits. And importantly, they are illiquid, meaning you can't turn it into cash in a pinch like you can with a real security like a stock. Now, I'm not saying you gotta stop collecting whatever you enjoy. Just make sure you're paying down your high interest debt like credit cards and saving for retirement. For more tips on saving more and spending less, search up Work Money Media on YouTube. Till next time, this is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
Mad Radio, WMDX, Madison's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour, next hour as well. It is a broadcast, a weekend broadcast, focusing on the Supreme Court almost exclusively because the Supreme Court, once again, beginning to issue some of these major opinions. We have spent a lot of time appropriately talking about this bump stock case. Why? Because it implicates both firearms in America, but even more centrally, it also represents another attack, if you will, by the Supreme Court on the determination by an agency, its actions intended to keep us safe and secure. Bump stocks, this rule regulating them, now tossed out by the Supreme Court, and they will now be legal in America as they were prior to the Trump administration, the Biden administration, restricting and prohibiting their sale, their use in America. On Thursday of this past week, the Supreme Court issued three other opinions in a variety of different areas. We'll spend some time now beginning to talk about the first of those three cases. And yes, indeed, it is one of the two abortion cases pending before the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, when it 2 years ago this month issued its opinion in Dobbs overturning Roe versus Wade, overturning 49 years of judicial precedent and history in our nation, basically was trying to send this issue, the abortion issue, back to the states, as it did, and determining that there is not a privacy right inside the Constitution that protects a woman's right to abortion as it had done for 49, almost 50 years prior to that, hoping plainly, that these matters would not now come back to it. And indeed, here they are. They're back again in at least two cases, including one of them involving a drug, one of the most commonly used drugs in accomplishing abortion, the medical service, the reproductive service in America. That drug, of course, is mifepristone. It is one of two principal drugs used for that legitimate, appropriate medical procedure involving a patient and a doctor. Supreme Court on Thursday maintaining access to that widely available abortion pill, and it rejected basically a petition by a group of anti-abortion organizations and some doctors to undo, and here we go again, another agency, the Food and Drug Administration's approval of that drug. And so this is both an abortion case, a reproductive rights case, a Privacy Rights Act case, but once again, it is determining whether or not an agency can, in fact, do what it has done in this particular case. In a unanimous decision, 9-0, unlike the bump stock case, this one is 9-0, supporting, upholding what the agency has done. It's written by Justice Brett Kavanaugh. The court held that these anti-abortion groups and the doctors lacked a direct state standing, if you will, in this dispute, a requirement to challenge this approval of the pill, mifepristone, by the FDA. Justice Kavanaugh saying the plaintiffs do not prescribe or use mifepristone, and the FDA is not requiring them to do or refrain from doing anything. He added, a plaintiff's desire to make a drug less available for others does not establish standing to sue. Standing to sue. Now, before we get back to the specifics in this particular case, let's talk, as we have before, more about standing. Because in the end, this is not a decision that necessarily endorses or fails to endorse the drug, but basically says you've got the wrong plaintiffs here. The people who brought this case in the first place do not have an identifiable claim to make. Justice Antonin Scalia once said in another opinion that the standing doctrine basically requires plaintiffs to ask the question, what's it to you? That's what Justice Antonin Scalia said. The plaintiffs in this case, who are doctors and medical associations who oppose abortion, apparently had no good answer to that question, which is what Justice Kavanaugh was writing all about. The main theory there is that there was a statistical probability, according to this case, this mifepristone case, that some doctors may at some point down the road, somehow, some way, work in an emergency room and have to treat patients suffering from complications after taking the pill, thereby subjecting the doctors to some kind of enormous stress and pressure and making them choose between their consciences and their professional obligations. That was a petition. That was the basis upon which these doctors and associations were seeking review by the court. That was their claim to standing. That was the argument that they were making, that they could, in fact, suffer damages here. Justice Kavanaugh, again, a majority, a unanimous Supreme Court, rejected that out of hand, said this: the plaintiff doctors and medical associations are unregulated parties who seek to challenge the FDA's regulation of others, italics in that language. Specifically, the court went on to say the FDA's regulations apply to doctors prescribing mifepristone and to pregnant women taking mifepristone. This, again, all part of the unanimous opinion. But the plaintiff doctors, Kavanaugh writes, and medical associations do not prescribe or use mifepristone, and FDA has not required these plaintiffs to do anything or refrain from doing anything. Again, that's the key language in all of this. It is significant, he also wrote, that these so-called conscience protections that are in federal law, those exist, those are there, ensure that these very plaintiffs do not have to perform abortions or deal with possible complications from them. That was also a significant portion of the Supreme Court decision. The standing doctrine can mean that some legal questions will never get answered in federal court, Justice Kavanaugh wrote. Some issues, he wrote, may be left to the political and democratic processes. There are other avenues to try to limit the availability of the pills. That's what the justice wrote on behalf of the unanimous Supreme Court. And that language underscores this, that plainly the issue of mifepristone and its viability in America remains a possible target of attack. It remains legal today in the wake of this decision of just this past week, presumably as do other decisions by the FDA. The FDA for 25 years or so determining that FDA is indeed safe and secure to be taken based upon its analysis, its long level of expertise and testing for about a quarter century or so. This case, again, makes the determination that mifepristone can remain a part of our medical cabinet, if you will, but not based upon a finding about its efficacy, but rather that these particular plaintiffs challenging that are not properly here. Citizens and doctors who object to what the law allows others to do may always take their concerns to the executive and legislative branches and seek greater regulatory or legislative restrictions on certain activities, basically almost inviting, if you will, a future attack. That's in the opinion. That language is in the opinion of the Supreme Court coming out just this past week. That, of course, echoing this sentiment, again, in the court's 2020 decision that overturned Roe, which said that abortion issues should now be left to the elected branches. We've got more of that kind of language coming out in this particular case as well. That is no small matter. That is no small decision, again, coming out of the Supreme Court just this past week. And as we continue, we will talk more about the Supreme Court decisions of this past week and others coming forward here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to Mad Radio, WMDX, Madison's home for the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Milwaukee Journal Sentinel music critic Piet Levy, who joins the show to discuss all things Summerfest. We will also discuss the resurgence of the summer box office.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9.
Welcome to the Lazy Oaf Lounge, Madison's east side place for friends and family to meet for fun and food. Stop in for great daily lunch specials, soups made from scratch, and jaw-dropping burgers, wraps, and sandwiches. Plus Friday fish fry and homemade pizza cooked in a classic stone hearth pizza oven. The Lazy Oaf Lounge, 1617 North Stoughton Road in Madison. Follow them on Facebook or at LazyOafLounge.com.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. You're listening to Mad Radio. WMDX 1580 AM Columbus, W224 EG Madison, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.